Chapter 28. Isabel woke in a pitch-black room, in pain.
"You're awake, aren't you?" said a voice beside her.
She recognized Gaetan's voice. How often in the past 2 years had she imagined lying in bed with him?
"Gaetan," she said,
and with his name came the memories. The barn. Beck. She sat up so fast her head spun and dizziness hit her hard.
"Viens,"
she said.
"Your sister is fine."
He lit the oil lamp and left it on the overturned apple crate by the bed. The butterscotch glow embraced them, created a small oval world in the blackness. She touched the spot of pain in her shoulder, wincing.
"The bastard shot me,"
she said, surprised to realize that such a thing could be forgotten. She remembered hiding the airman and getting caught by Vianne. She remembered being in the cellar with the dead flyer.
"And you shot him?"
She remembered Beck flinging the hatch door open and pointing his pistol at her. She remembered 2 gunshots and climbing out of the cellar, staggering, feeling dizzy. Had she known she'd been shot? Vianne holding a shovel covered in gore. Beside her, Beck in a pool of blood. Vianne, pale as chalk, trembling.
"I killed him."
After that, her memories were jumbled except for Vianne's anger.
"You are not welcome here. If you return, I'll turn you in myself."
Isabel lay back down slowly. The pain of that memory was worse than her injury. For once, Vianne had been right to cast Isabel out. What had she been thinking to hide the airman on her sister's property, with a German Wehrmacht captain billeted there? No wonder people didn't trust her.
"How long have I been here?"
4 days. "Your wound is much improved. Your sister stitched it up nicely. Your fever broke yesterday."
"And Vianne? She is not fine, of course. So how is she?"
"We protected her as best we could. She refused to go into hiding. So Henri and Didier buried both bodies and cleaned the barn and tore the motorcycle down to parts."
"She'll be questioned," Isabel said. "And killing that man will haunt her. Hating doesn't come easy for her."
"It will before this war is over."
Isabel felt her stomach tighten in shame and regret.
"I love her, you know. Or I want to. How come I forget that the minute we disagree about something?"
"She said something very similar at the frontier."
Isabel started to roll over and gasped at the pain in her shoulder. Taking a deep breath, she steeled herself and eased slowly onto her side. She'd misjudged how close he was to her, how small the bed. They were lying like lovers, she on her side looking up at him, he on his back staring at the ceiling.
"Vianne went to the border?"
"You were in a coffin in the back of the wagon. She wanted to make sure we crossed safely."
She heard a smile in his voice, or imagined she did.
"She threatened to kill me if I didn't take good care of you."
"My sister said that?"
she said, not quite believing it. But she hardly believed that Gaetan was the kind of man who would lie to reunite sisters. In profile, his features were razor sharp, even by lamplight. He refused to look at her, and he was as close to the edge of the bed as he could be.
"She was afraid you'd die. We both were."
He said it so softly she barely could hear.
"It feels like old times," she said cautiously,
afraid to say the wrong thing, more afraid to say nothing at all. Who knew how many chances there would be in such uncertain times?
"You and me alone in the dark, remember?"
"I remember."
"Tour already feels like a lifetime ago," she went on.
"I was just a girl." He said nothing.
"Look at me, Gaetan."
"Go to sleep, Isabel."
"You know I will keep asking until you can't stand it."
He sighed and rolled onto his side.
"I think about you," she said.
Don't.
His voice was rough.
You kissed me, she said. It wasn't a dream.
You can't remember that.
Isabel felt something strange at his words. A breathless little flutter in her chest.
You want me as much as I want you, she said.
He shook his head in denial, but it was the silence she heard, the acceleration of his breathing.
You think I'm too young and too innocent and too impetuous, too everything. I get it. People have always said that about me. I'm immature.
That's not it.
But you're wrong. Maybe you weren't wrong 2 years ago. I did say I love you, which must have sounded insane.
She drew in a breath.
But it's not insane now, Gaetan. Maybe it's the only sane thing in all of this. Love, I mean. We've seen buildings blown up in front of us, and our friends are getting arrested and deported. God knows if we'll ever see them again. I could die, Gaetan, she said quietly. I'm not saying that in some schoolgirl try to get the boy to kiss me kind of way. It's true, and you know it. Either one of us could die tomorrow. And you know what I would regret?
What? Us. There can't be an us is, not now. That's what I've been trying to tell you from the beginning.
If I promise to let it go, will you answer one question truthfully?
Just one?
One. And then I'll go to sleep, I promise.
He nodded.
If we weren't here, hiding in a safe house, if the world weren't ripping itself apart, if this was just an ordinary day in an ordinary world, would you want there to be an us, Gaetan?
She saw how his face crumpled, how pain exposed his love.
It doesn't matter, don't you see that?
It's the only thing that matters, Gaetan.
She saw love in his eyes. What did words matter after that? She was wiser than she'd been before. Now she knew how fragile life and love were. Maybe she would love him for only this day, or maybe for only the next week, or maybe until she was an old, old woman. Maybe he would be the love of her life, or her love for the duration of this war, or maybe he would only be her first love. All she really knew was that in this terrible, frightening world, she had stumbled into something unexpected. And she would not let it go again.
I knew it, she said to herself, smiling.
His breath skimmed against her lips, as intimate as any kiss. She leaned over him, her gaze on him, steady, honest, and turned off the lamp. In the dark, she snuggled against him, burrowed deeper under the blankets. At first he lay stiffly against her, as if he were afraid even to touch her, but gradually he relaxed. He rolled onto his back and started to snore. Sometime, she didn't know when, she closed her eyes and reached out, placing a hand in the hollow of his stomach, feeling it rise and fall with his breathing. It was like resting her hand on the ocean in summer, when the tide was coming in. Touching him, she fell asleep. The nightmares wouldn't let her go. In some distant part of her brain, she heard her own whimpering, heard Sophie say,
Maman, you're taking all the blankets.
But none of it wakened her. In her nightmare, she was in a chair being interrogated.
The boy, Daniel. He's a Jew. Give him to me,
Van Richter said, shoving his gun in her face. Then his face changed, melted a little, and he turned into Beck, who was holding the photograph of his wife and shaking his head. But the side of his face was missing, and then Isabel, lying on the floor, bleeding, saying,
I'm sorry, Vian.
And Vian was yelling,
You're not welcome here.
Vian woke with a start, breathing hard. The same nightmares had plagued her for 6 days. She consistently woke, feeling exhausted and worried. It was November now, and there had been no word about Isabel at all. She eased out from beneath the blankets. The floor was cold, but not as cold as it would be in a few weeks. She reached for the shawl she'd left on the foot of the bed and wrapped it around her shoulders. Von Richter had claimed the upstairs bedroom. Vianne had abandoned the floor to him, choosing to move with her children into the smaller downstairs bedroom, where they slept together on the double bed. Beck's room. No wonder she dreamt of him in here. The air held onto his scent, reminded her that the man she'd known no longer lived, that she had killed him. She longed to do penance for this sin, but what could she do? She had killed a man, a decent man, in spite of it all. It didn't matter to her that he was the enemy, or even that she'd done it to save her sister. She knew she had made the right choice. It wasn't right or wrong that haunted her. It was the act itself. Murder. She left the bedroom and closed the door behind her, shutting it with a quiet click. Von Richter sat on the divan, reading a novel, drinking a cup of real coffee. The aroma made her almost sick with longing. The Nazi had billeted here for several days already, and each of those mornings had smelled of rich, bitter roasted coffee, and Von Richter made sure she smelled it and wanted it. But she couldn't have so much as a sip. He made sure of that, too. Yesterday morning, he had dumped an entire pot into the sink, smiling at her as he did so. He was a man who had stumbled into a little bit of power and seized it with both hands. She'd known that within the first few hours of his arrival, when he'd chosen the best room and gathered up the warmest blankets for his bed, when he'd taken all of the pillows left in the house and all of the candles, leaving Vianne a single oil lamp for her use. "Herr Sturmbannführer," she said, smoothing her shapeless dress and worn cardigan. He didn't look up from the German newspaper that held his attention.
"More coffee."
She took his empty cup and went to the kitchen, returning quickly with another cup.
"The Allies are wasting their time in North Africa," he said,
taking the cup from her, putting it on the table beside him.
"Oui, Herr Sturmbannführer."
His hand snaked out and coiled around her wrist, tight enough to leave a bruise.
"I am having men over for supper tonight. You will cook. And keep that boy away from me. His crying sounds like a dying pig."
He let go.
"Oui, Herr Sturmbannführer."
She got out of his way quickly, hurrying into the bedroom and closing the door behind her. She bent and wakened Daniel, feeling his soft breathing against the crook of her neck.
"Maman,"
he mumbled around his thumb, which he was furiously sucking.
"Sophie is snoring too loud."
Vianne smiled and reached over to tousle Sophie's hair. Amazingly, even though it was wartime and they were terrified and starving, somehow a girl her age could still manage to sleep through anything.
"You sound like a water buffalo, Sophie," Vianne teased.
"Very funny,"
Sophie muttered, sitting up. She glanced at the closed door.
"Is Herr Dorifor still here?"
"Sophie,"
Vianne admonished, glancing worriedly at the closed door.
"He can't hear us,"
Sophie said.
"Still,"
Vianne said quietly.
"I cannot imagine why you would compare our guest to a bug that eats potatoes."
She tried not to smile. Danielle hugged Vianne and gave her a sloppy kiss. As she patted his back and held him close, nuzzling the downy softness of his cheek, she heard a car engine start up.
"Thank God. He is leaving," she murmured to the boy, nuzzling his cheek. "Come along, Sophie."
She carried Daniel into the living room, which still smelled of freshly brewed coffee and men's cologne, and began her day. People had called Isabel impetuous for as long as she could remember, and then rash, and most lately, reckless. In the past year, she had grown up enough to see the truth in it. From earliest memory, she had acted first and thought about consequences later. Perhaps it was because she'd felt alone for so long. No one had ever been her sounding board, her best friend. She hadn't had someone with whom to strategize or work through her problems. Beyond that, she had never had great impulse control, maybe because she'd never had anything to lose. Now, she knew what it meant to be afraid, to want something or someone. So much it made your heart ache. The old Isabel would simply have told Gaëtan she loved him and let the cards fall as they would. The new Isabel wanted to walk away without even trying. She didn't know if she had the strength to be rejected again. And yet, they were at war. Time was the one luxury no one had anymore. Tomorrow felt as ephemeral as a kiss in the dark. She stood in the small, pitch-roofed cupboard they used as a water closet in the safe house. Gaëtan had carried up buckets of hot water for her bath, and she had luxuriated in the copper tub until the water cooled. The mirror on the wall was cracked and hung askew. It made her reflection appear disjointed, with one side of her face slightly lower than the other. "How can you be afraid?" she said to her reflection. She had hiked the Pyrenees in the falling snow and swum the rushing cold waters of the Bidasoa River beneath the glare of a Spanish searchlight. She'd once asked a Gestapo agent to carry a suitcase full of false identity papers across a German checkpoint because he looked so strong and she was so very tired from traveling. But she had never been as nervous as she was right now. She knew suddenly that a woman could change her whole life and uproot her existence with one choice. Taking a deep breath, she wrapped herself in a tattered towel and returned to the safe house's main room. She paused at the door just long enough to calm her racing heart, a failed attempt, and then she opened the door. Gaëtan stood by the blacked-out window in his torn and tattered clothes, still stained with her blood. She smiled nervously and reached for the end of the towel she'd tucked in at her chest. He went so still, it seemed he'd stopped breathing, even as her breathing sped up. "Don't do it, Iz." His eyes narrowed. Before, she would have said it was anger, but now she knew better. She unwrapped the towel, let it fall to the floor. The bandage on her gunshot wound was all she wore now.
"What do you want from me?"
he said.
"You know. You're an innocent. It's war. I'm a criminal. How many reasons do you need to stay away from me?"
They were arguments for another world.
"If times were different, I'd make you chase me," she said, taking a step forward. "I would have made you jump through hoops to get me naked. But we don't have time, do we?"
At the quiet admission, she felt a wave of sadness. This had been the truth between them from the beginning. They had no time. They couldn't court and fall in love and get married and have babies. They might not even have tomorrow. She hated that her first time would be bathed in sorrow, steeped in a sense of having already lost what they'd just found. But that was the world now. One thing she knew for sure. She wanted him to be the first man in her bed. She wanted to remember him for as long as forever was.
"The nuns always said I would come to a bad end."
"I think they meant you." He came toward her, cupped her face in his hands.
"You terrify me, Isabel."
"Kiss me," was all she could say. At the first touch of his lips, everything changed, or Isabel changed. A shudder of desire moved through her, stopped her breath. She felt lost within his arms and found, broken apart and remade. The words, "I love you," burned in her, desperate to be given voice. But even more, she wanted to hear the words, to be told just once that she was loved.
"You're going to be sorry you did this," he said.
How could he say that?
"Never. Will you be sorry?"
"I already am," he said quietly. Then he kissed her again. Chapter 29 The next week was one of almost unbearable bliss for Isabel. There were long conversations by candlelight, and holding hands, and stroking skin, nights of awaking into an aching desire and making love and falling into sleep again. On this day, as on each of the others, Isabel woke still tired and slightly in pain. The wound in her shoulder had begun healing enough that it itched and ached. She felt Gaëtan beside her, his body warm and solid. She knew he was awake. Maybe it was his breathing, or the way his foot rubbed absently against hers, or the quiet. She just knew. In the past days, she'd become a student of him. Nothing he did was too small or insignificant for her to notice. She'd repeatedly thought, "Remember this," over the smallest of details. She had read countless romantic novels in her life, and she had dreamed of love forever. Even so, she'd never known that a plain old double mattress could become a world unto itself, an oasis. She turned onto her side and reached past Gaëtan to light the lamp. In the pale glow of it, she settled close to him, an arm draped across his chest. A tiny silver scar cut through his messy hairline. She reached out to touch it, traced it with her fingertip.
"My brother threw a rock at me. I was too slow to duck," he said. "Georges," he said fondly.
The tenor of his voice reminded Isabel that Gaëtan's brother was a prisoner of war. He had a whole life she knew almost nothing about. A mother who was a seamstress and a father who raised pigs. He lived in the woods somewhere, in a house with no running water and only a single room for all of them. He answered her questions about all of it, but volunteered almost nothing. He said he preferred to hear her stories about the adventures that had gotten her kicked out of so many schools.
"It's better than stories of poor people just trying to get by," he said.
But beneath all their words, the stories traded back and forth, she felt their time eroding. They couldn't stay here long. Already, they'd overstayed. She was fit enough to travel, not to cross the Pyrenees, perhaps, but certainly she didn't need to lie abed. How could she leave him? They might never see each other again. That was the crux of her fear.
"I get it, you know," Gaëtan said.
She didn't know what he meant, but she heard the hollowness in his voice and knew it wasn't good. The sadness that came from being in his bed matched equally with joy, expanded.
"Get what?"
she asked, but she didn't want to hear.
"That every time we kiss, it's goodbye."
She closed her eyes.
"The war is out there, Is. I need to get back to it."
She knew and agreed, though it caused a constriction in her chest.
"I know,"
was all she could say, afraid that any deeper exploration would hurt more than she could bear.
"There is a group gathering at Arugne," she said. "I should be there by nightfall on Wednesday, if we're lucky."
"We are not lucky," he said. "You must know that by now."
"You are wrong, Gaëtan. Now that you've met me, you'll never be able to forget me. That's something."
She leaned over for a kiss. He said something softly, quietly against her lips. Maybe it was,
"It's not enough."
She didn't care. She didn't want to hear. In November, the people of Carrevaux began to hunker down into winter survival mode again. They knew now what they hadn't known last winter. Life could get worse. War was being waged all over the world, in Africa, in the Soviet Union, in Japan, on an island somewhere called Guadalcanal. With the Germans fighting on so many fronts, food had become even more scarce, as had wood and gas and electricity and everyday supplies. This Friday morning was particularly cold and gray. Not a good day for venturing out. But Vian had decided that today was the day. It had taken some time to work up the courage to leave the house with Daniel, but she knew that it had to be done. His hair was cut so short he was almost bald, and she dressed him in oversized clothes to make him look smaller, anything to disguise him. She forced herself to show good posture as she walked through town, with a child on each side of her, Sophie and Daniel. Daniel. At the boulangerie, she took her place at the back of the queue. She waited breathlessly for someone to ask about the boy beside her, but the women in line were too tired and hungry and downtrodden even to look up. When it was finally Vianne's turn at the counter, Yvette looked up. She had been a beautiful woman only 2 years ago, with flowing copper-colored hair and eyes as black as coal. Now, 3 years into the war, she looked aged and tired.
"Vianne Mauriac, I have not seen you with your daughter for a while. Bonjour, Sophie. You have grown so tall."
She peered over the counter.
"And who is this good-looking young man?"
"Daniel,"
he said proudly. Vianne placed a trembling hand on his shorn head.
"I adopted him from Antoine's cousin in Nice. She died."
Yvette pushed the frizzy hair out of her eyes, pulled a strand of it out of her mouth as she stared down at the toddler. She had 3 sons of her own, one not much older than Daniel. Vianne's heart hammered in her chest. Yvette stepped back from the counter. She went to the small door that separated the shop from the bakery.
"Herr Lieutenant," she said, "could you come out here?"
Vianne tightened her grip on her willow basket handle, working it as if it were piano keys. A portly German ambled out of the back room, his arms overflowing with freshly baked baguettes. He saw Vianne and stopped.
"Madame,"
he said, his apple cheeks bulging at the fullness of his mouth. Vianne could barely nod. Yvette said to the soldier,
"There's no more bread today, Herr Lieutenant. If I make more, I will save the best for you and your men. This poor woman couldn't even get a day-old baguette."
The man's eyes narrowed appreciatively. He moved toward Vianne, his flat feet thumping on the stone floor. Wordlessly, he dropped a half-eaten baguette into her basket. Then he nodded and left the shop, a little bell tinkling at his exit. When they were alone, Yvette moved in close to Vianne, so close she had to fight the urge to step back.
"I heard you have an SS officer in your house now. What happened to the handsome captain?"
"He disappeared," Vianne said evenly.
"No one knows."
"No one? Why did they bring you in for questioning? Everyone saw you go in."
"I am just a housewife. What could I possibly know of such things?"
Yvette stared at her a moment longer, assessing Vianne in the silence. Then she stepped back.
"You are a good friend, Vianne Mauriac," she said quietly.
Vianne nodded briefly and herded the children to the door. The days of stopping to talk to friends on the street were gone. Now it was dangerous enough to simply make eye contact. Friendly conversation had gone the way of butter and coffee and pork. Outside, Vianne paused on the cracked stone step, through which a lush patch of frosted weeds pushed up. She was wearing a winter coat she had made from a tapestried bedspread. She had copied a pattern she'd seen in a magazine, double-breasted, knee-length, with a wide lapel and button she'd taken from one of her mother's favorite Harris tweed jackets. It was warm enough for today, but soon she would need layers of newsprint between her sweater and her coat. Vianne retied the scarf around her head and knotted it more tightly beneath her chin as the icy wind hit her full in the face. Leaves skittered across the stone aisle, cartwheeled across her booted feet. She held tightly to Daniel's mittened hand and stepped out into the street. She knew instantly that something was wrong. There were German soldiers and French gendarmes everywhere, in cars, on motorcycles, marching up the icy street, gathered in pods at the cafes. Whatever was happening out here, it couldn't be good. And it was always best to stay away from the soldiers, especially since the Allied victories in North Africa.
Come on, Sophie and Daniel. Let's go home.
She tried to turn right at the corner, but found the street barricaded. All up and down the street, doors were locked and shutters were closed. The bistros were empty. There was a terrible sense of danger in the air. The next street she tried was barricaded, too. A pair of Nazi soldiers stood guard at it, their rifles pointed at her. Behind them, German soldiers marched up the street toward them, goose-stepping in formation. Vian took the children's hands and picked up their pace, but one street after another was barricaded and guarded. It became clear that there was a plan in place. Lorries and buses were thundering up the cobblestone streets toward the town square. Vian came to the square and stopped, breathing hard, pulling the children in close to her sides. Pandemonium. There were buses lined up in a row, disgorging passengers, all of whom wore a yellow star. Women and children were being forced, pushed, herded into the square. Nazis stood on the perimeter, a terrible, frightening patrol edge, while French policemen pulled people out of the buses, yanked jewelry from women's necks, shoved them at gunpoint.
Maman!
Sophie cried. Vian clamped a hand over her daughter's mouth. To her left, a young woman was shoved to the ground and then hauled back up by her hair and dragged through the crowd.
Vian!
She swung around, saw Hélène Ruel carrying a small leather suitcase and holding a little boy's hand. An older boy stood close to her side. A yellow, tattered star identified them.
Take my sons, Hélène said desperately to Vian. Here?
Vian said, glancing around.
No, maman, the older boy said. Papa told me to take care of you. I am not leaving you. If you let go of my hand, I'll just follow you. Better we stay together.
Behind them, another whistle shrieked. Hélène shoved the younger boy into Vian, pushed him hard against Daniel.
He is Jean-Georges, like his uncle. 4 years old this June. My husband's people are in Burgundy. I have no papers for him. They'll kill me if I take him.
You,
a Nazi shouted at Hélène. He came up behind her, grabbed her by the hair, almost yanking her off her feet. She slammed into her older son, who strove to keep her upright. And then Hélène and her son were gone, lost in the crowd. The boy was beside her, wailing,
Maman!
And sobbing.
We need to leave, Vian said to Sophie. Now!
She clutched Jean-Georges' hand so tightly he cried harder. Every time he yelled,
Maman!
She flinched and prayed for him to be quiet. They hurried up one street and down the other, dodging the barricades and bypassing the soldiers who were breaking down doors and herding Jewish people into the square. Twice they were stopped and allowed to pass because they had no stars on their clothing. On the muddy road, she had to slow down, but she didn't stop, even when both boys started crying. At Le Jardin, Vian finally stopped. Von Richter's black Citroën was parked out front.
Oh, no,
Sophie said. Vian looked down at her terrified daughter and saw her own fear replicated in the beloved eyes, and all at once she knew what she needed to do. We have to try to save him, or we are as bad as they are, she said. And there it was. She hated to bring her daughter into this, but what choice was there?
I have to save this boy.
How?
I don't know yet, Vian admitted. But von Richter...
As if drawn by his own name, the Nazi appeared at the front door, looking fussily precise in his uniform.
Ah, Madame Mauriac, he said, his gaze narrowing as he approached her. There you are.
Vian struggled for calm.
We have been to town for shopping.
Not a good day for that. Jews are being collected for deportation.
He walked toward her, his boots tamping down the wet grass. Beside him, the apple tree was barren of leaves. Bits of fabric fluttered from the empty branches. Red, pink, white. A new one for Beck, in black.
And who is this fine-looking youngster?
Von Richter said, touching the child's tear-streaked cheek with one black-gloved finger.
A friend's boy. His mother died of tuberculosis this week.
Von Richter lurched backwards, as if she'd said bubonic plague.
I don't want that child in the house. Is that understood? You will take him to the orphanage this instant.
The orphanage. Mother Marie-Thérèse. She nodded.
Of course, Herr Sturmbannführer.
He made a flicking gesture with his hand as if to say,
Go, now.
He started to walk away. Then he stopped and turned back to face Vianne.
I want you home this evening for supper.
I am always home, Herr Sturmbannführer.
We leave tomorrow, and I want you to feed me and my men a good meal before we go.
Leave?
She asked, feeling a spike of hope.
We are occupying the rest of France tomorrow. No more free zone. It's about damn time. Letting you French govern yourselves was a joke. Good day, madam.
Vianne remained where she was, standing still, holding the child's hand. Above the sound of Jean-Georges crying, she heard the gate squeak open and slam shut. Then a car engine started up. When he was gone, Sophie said,
Will Mother Marie-Thérèse hide him?
I hope so. Take Daniel into the house and lock the door. Don't open it for anyone but me. I'll be back as soon as I can.
Sophie looked old for her age suddenly, wise beyond her years.
Good for you, Maman.
We shall see.
Was all the hope she had left. When her children were safely in the house, with the door locked, she said to the boy beside her,
Come, Jean-Georges, we are going for a walk. To my maman?
She couldn't look at him.
Come.
As Vianne and the boy walked back to town, an intermittent rain began. Jean-Georges alternately cried and complained. But Vianne was so nervous she barely heard him. How could she ask Mother Superior to take this risk? How could she not? They walked past the church to the convent hidden behind it. The Order of the Sisters of St. Joseph had begun in 1650 with six like-minded women who simply wanted to serve the poor in their community. They had grown to thousands of members throughout France until religious communities were forbidden by the state during the French Revolution. Some of the original six sisters had become martyrs for their beliefs, guillotined for their faith. Vianne went to the abbey's front door and lifted the heavy iron knocker, letting it fall against the oak door, clattering hard.
Why are we here?
Jean-Georges whined.
Is my maman here?
Shh!
A nun answered, her sweet, plump face bracketed by the white wimple and black hood of her habit.
Ah, Vianne,
she said, smiling. Sister Agatha, I would like to speak to Mother Superior, if that's possible. The nun stepped back, her habit swishing on the stone floor.
I will see. You two take a seat in the garden.
Vianne nodded. Merci. She and Jean-Georges made their way through the cold cloisters. At the end of one arched corridor, they turned left and went into the garden. It was good-sized and square, with frosted brown grass and a marble lion's head fountain and several stone benches placed here and there. Vianne took a seat on one of the cold benches out of the rain and pulled the boy up beside her. She didn't have long to wait.
Vianne, Mother said, coming forward, her habit dragging on the grass,
Her fingers closed around the large crucifix that hung from a chain around her neck.
How good it is to see you. It's been too long. And who is this young man?
The boy looked up.
Is my maman here?
Vian met Mother Superior's even gaze with one of her own. His name is Jean-Georges Rouel, Mother. I would speak to you alone if we could. Mother clapped her hands, and a young nun appeared to take the boy away. When they were alone, Mother Superior sat down beside Vian. Vian couldn't corral her thoughts, and so a silence fell between them.
I am sorry about your friend Rachel.
And so many others, Vian said. Mother nodded.
We have heard terrible rumors coming from Radio London about what is happening in the camps.
Perhaps our Holy Father...
He is silent on this matter, Mother said, her voice heavy with disappointment.
Vian took a deep breath. Hélène Rouel and her elder son were deported today. Jean-Georges is alone. His mother left him with me.
Left him with you?
Mother paused.
It is dangerous to have a Jewish child in your home, Vian.
I want to protect him, she said quietly. Mother looked at her. She was silent so long that Vian's fear began to put down roots, grow.
And how would you accomplish this?
She asked at last. Hide him.
Where?
Vian looked at Mother, saying nothing. Mother's face drained of color.
Here?
An orphanage. What better place? Mother Superior stood and then sat. Then she stood again. Her hands moved to the cross, held it. Slowly, she sat down again. Her shoulders sagged, and then straightened when her decision was made.
A child in our care needs papers. Baptismal certificates.
I can get those, of course, but identity papers. I will get them, Vian said, although she had no idea if it were possible.
You know that it is illegal to hide Jews now. The punishment is deportation if you're lucky, and lately, I believe no one is lucky in France.
Vian nodded. Then Mother Superior said,
I will take the boy, and I could make room for more than one Jewish child.
More?
Of course there are more, Vian. I will speak to a man I know in Giraud. He works for L'œuvre de secours aux enfants, the Help the Children Fund. I expect he will know many families and children in hiding. I will tell him to expect you.
Me?
You are the leader of this now, and if we are risking our lives for one child, we may as well try to save more.
Mother got abruptly to her feet. She hooked her arm through Vian's, and the two women strolled the perimeter of the small garden.
No one here can know the truth. The children will have to be coached and have paperwork that passes inspection. And you would need a position here. Perhaps as a teacher, as a part-time teacher, that would allow us to pay you a small stipend and would answer questions about why you were here with the children.
Vian said, feeling shaky.
Don't look so afraid, Vian. You are doing the right thing.
She had no doubt that this was true, and still she was terrified.
This is what they have done to us. We are afraid of our own shadows.
She looked at Mother.
How will I do it? Go to scared, hungry women and ask them to give me their children?
You will ask them if they've seen their friends being herded onto trains and taken away. You will ask them what they would risk to keep their child off of that train. Then you will let each mother decide.
It is an unimaginable choice. I'm not sure I could do it, just hand Sophie and Daniel over to a stranger.
Mother leaned close.
I hear one of their awful stormtroopers is billeted at your house. You realize this puts you and Sophie at terrible risk.
Of course. But how can I let her believe it's all right to do nothing in times such as these?
Mother stopped. Releasing Vian, she laid a soft palm against her cheek and smiled tenderly.
Be careful, Vian. I have already been to your mother's funeral. I do not want to attend yours.
Chapter 30. On an ice-cold mid-November day, Isabel and Gaëtan left Brantôme and boarded a train to Bayonne. The carriage was overflowing with solemn German soldiers, more so than usual, and when they disembarked, they found more soldiers crowding the platform. Isabel held Gaëtan's hand as they made their way through the gray-green uniforms. Two young lovers on their way to the beach town. My maman used to love going to the beach. Did I ever tell you that? Isabel asked as they passed near two SS officers.
You rich kids see all the good stuff.
She smiled.
We were hardly rich, Gaëtan, she said, when they were outside the train station.
Well, you weren't poor, he said. I know poor.
He paused, let that settle between them, and then he said,
I could be rich someday. Someday,
he said again with a sigh, and she knew what he was thinking. It was what they were always thinking. Will there be a France in our future? Gaëtan slowed. Isabel saw what had captured his attention.
Keep moving, he said.
A roadblock had been set up ahead of them. Troops were everywhere, carrying rifles.
What's going on? Isabel asked.
They've seen us, Gaëtan said.
He tightened his hold on her hand. They strolled toward the swarm of German soldiers. A burly, square-headed sentry blocked their way and demanded to see their passes and papers. Isabel offered her Juliet papers. Gaëtan offered his own false documents, but the soldier was more interested in the goings-on behind him. He barely glanced at the documents and handed them back. Isabel gave him her most innocent smile.
What's happening today?
No more free zone, the soldier said, waving them through.
No more free zone? But...
We are taking over all of France, he said roughly. No more pretense that your ridiculous Vichy government is in charge anywhere. Go!
Gaëtan pulled her forward through the amassing troops. For hours as they walked, they were honked at by German lorries and automobiles in a hurry to get past them. It wasn't until they reached the quaint seaside town of Saint-Jean-de-Luz that they were able to escape the gathering Nazis. They walked along the empty seawall, perched high above the pounding surf of the Atlantic Ocean. Below them, a curl of yellow sand held the mighty, angry ocean at bay. In the distance, a lush green peninsula was dotted with houses built in the Basque tradition, with white sides and red doors and bright red tile roofs. The sky overhead was a faded, washed-out blue, with clouds stretched as taut as clotheslines. There were no other people out today, neither on the beach nor walking along the ancient seawall. For the first time in hours, Isabel could breathe.
What does it mean, no free zone?
It is not good, that's for sure. It will make your work more dangerous.
I've been moving through occupied territory already.
She tightened her hold on his hand and led him off the seawall. They stepped down the uneven steps and made their way to the road.
We used to vacation here when I was little, she said, before my maman died.
At least that's what I've heard. I barely remember. She wanted it to be the start of a conversation, but her words fell into the new silence between them and went unanswered. In the quiet, Isabel felt the suffocating weight of missing him, even though he was holding her hand. Why hadn't she asked him more questions in their days together, gotten to know everything about him? Now there was no time left, and they both knew it. They walked in a heavy silence.
In the haze of early evening, Gaetan got his first glimpse of the Pyrenees. The jagged, snow-dusted mountains rose into the leaden sky, their snow-tipped peaks ringed in clouds.
Maeld, you crossed those mountains how many times?
27.
You're a wonder, he said.
I am, she said with a smile. They continued up through the dark, empty streets of Urugne, climbing with every step, moving past the closed-up shops and bistros full of old men. Beyond town lay the dirt path that led into the foothills. At last they came to the cottage, tucked into the dark foothills, its chimney puffing smoke.
Are you okay?
He asked, noticing that she had slowed her step. I will miss you, she said quietly. How long can you stay?
I have to leave in the morning.
She wanted to release the hold on his hand, but it was difficult. She had this terrible, irrational fear that if she let go of him, she would never touch him again, and the thought of that was paralyzing. Still, she had a job to do. She let go of him and knocked, 3 times sharply in rapid succession. Madame opened the door. Dressed in man's clothing, smoking a Gauloise, she said,
Juliet, come, come.
She stepped back, welcoming Isabel and Gaetan into the main room, where 4 airmen stood around the dining table. The fire burned in the hearth, and above the flames a black cast-iron pot bubbled and hissed and popped. Isabel could smell the stew's ingredients. Goat meat, wine, bacon, thick, rich stock, mushrooms, and sage. The aroma was heavenly and reminded her that she hadn't eaten all day. Madame gathered the men together and introduced them. There were 3 RAF pilots and an American flyer. The 3 Brits had been there for days, waiting for the American who had arrived yesterday. Eduardo would be leading them over the mountains tomorrow morning.
It's good to meet you, one of them said, shaking Isabel's hand as if she were a water pump. You're just as beautiful as we've been told.
The men started talking all at once. Gaetan moved easily into their midst, as if he belonged with them. Isabel stood beside Madame Babineau and handed her the envelope of money that should have been delivered almost 2 weeks earlier.
I'm sorry about the delay.
You had a good excuse. How are you feeling?
Isabel moved her shoulder, testing it.
Better. In another week, I'll be ready to make the crossing again.
Madame handed Isabel the Gauloise. Isabel took a long drag and exhaled, studying the men who were now in her charge.
How are they?
See the tall, thin one? Nose like a Roman emperor?
Isabel couldn't help smiling.
I see him.
He claims to be a lord or duke or something. Sarah in Po said he was trouble. Wouldn't follow a girl's orders.
Isabel made a note of that. It wasn't a rarity, of course, flyers who didn't want to take orders from women, or girls or dames or broads, but it was always a trial. She handed Isabel a crumpled, dirt-stained letter.
One of them gave me this to give to you.
She opened it quickly, scanned the contents. She recognized Henri's sloppy handwriting.
J. Your friend survived her German holiday, but she has guests. Do not stop by. We'll watch out for her.
Vianne was fine. She had been released after questioning, but another soldier or soldiers were billeted there. She crumpled the paper and tossed it in the fire. She didn't know whether to be relieved or more worried. Instinctively, her gaze sought out Gaetan, who was watching her as he spoke to an airman.
I see the way you're watching him, you know.
Lord Bignose?
Madame Babineau barked out a laugh.
I am old but not blind. The young handsome one with the hungry eyes. He keeps looking at you, too.
He'll be leaving tomorrow morning.
Ah.
Isabel turned to the woman who had become her friend in the past 2 years.
I'm afraid to let him go, which is crazy with all the dangerous things I do. The look in Madame's dark eyes was both knowing and compassionate.
I would tell you to be careful if these were ordinary times. I would point out that he is young and engaged in a dangerous business, and young men in danger can be fickle.
She sighed.
But we are cautious about too much these days. And why add love to the list?
Love, Isabel said quietly.
I will add this, though, since I am a mother and we can't help ourselves. A broken heart hurts as badly in wartime as in peace. Say goodbye to your young man well.
Isabel waited for the house to go quiet, or as quiet as a room could be with men sleeping on the floor, snoring, rolling over. Moving cautiously, she eased out of her blankets and picked her way through the main room and went outside. Stars flickered overhead, the sky immense in this dark landscape. Moonlight illuminated the goats, turned them into silver-white dots on the hillside. She stood at the wooden fence, staring out. She didn't have to wait long. Gaëtan came up behind her, put his arms around her. She leaned back into him. "I feel safe in your arms," she said. When he didn't respond, she knew something was wrong. Her heart sank. She turned slowly, looked up at him.
"What is it?"
"Isabel."
The way he said it frightened her. She thought, "No, don't tell me, whatever it is, don't tell me." In the silence, noises became noticeable. The bleating of goats, the beating of her heart, the tumbling of a rock down a distant hillside.
"That meeting, the one we were going to in Carivo when you found the airman."
"We?" she said. She had studied him so carefully in the past few days, watched every nuance of emotion cross his face, and she knew whatever he was going to say, it wouldn't be good.
"I'm leaving Paul's group. Fighting a different way."
"Different how?"
"With guns," he said quietly. "And bombs. Anything we can find. I'm joining a group of guerrilla partisans who live in the woods. My job is explosives," he smiled, "and stealing bomb parts."
"Your past should help you there."
Her teasing fell flat. His smile faded.
"I can't just deliver papers anymore, Iz. I need to do more. And I won't see you for a while, I think."
She nodded, but even as she moved her head in agreement, she thought, How will I walk away and leave him now? And she understood what he had been afraid of from the start. The look he gave her was as intimate as a kiss. In it, she saw her own fear reflected. They might never see each other again.
"Make love to me, Gaëtan," she said.
"Like it's the last time." Vianne stood outside the Hotel Bellevue in the pouring rain. The windows of the hotel were fogged. Through the haze, she could see a crowd of gray-green field uniforms.
"Come on, Vianne. You're in it now."
She squared her shoulders and opened the door. A bell tinkled gaily overhead, and the men in the room stopped what they were doing and turned to look at her. Wehrmacht, SS, Gestapo. She felt like a lamb going to slaughter. At the desk, Henri looked up. Seeing her, he came out from behind the front desk and moved swiftly through the crowd toward her. He took her by the arm, hissing,
"Smile."
She tried to comply. She wasn't sure whether she succeeded. He led her to the front desk, where he let go of her arm. He was saying something, laughing, as if at some joke, as he took his place by the heavy black phone and cash register.
"Your father, correct?" he said loudly. "A room for two nights?"
She nodded numbly.
"Here, let me show you the room we have available," he said at last.
She followed him out of the lobby and into the narrow hallway. They went past a small table set with fresh fruit. Only the Germans could afford such an extravagance,
and a water closet that was empty. At the end of the corridor, he led her up a narrow set of stairs and into a room so small there was only a single bed and a blacked-out window. He closed the door behind them.
You shouldn't be here. I sent you word that Isabel was fine.
Oui, merci. She took a deep breath. I need identity papers. You were the only person I could think of who might be able to help me.
He frowned.
That's a dangerous request, madame. For whom?
A Jewish child in hiding.
Hiding where?
I don't think you want to know that, do you?
No. No. Is it a safe place?
She shrugged, her answer obvious in the silence. Who knew what was safe anymore?
I hear Sturmbannführer von Richter is billeted with you. He was here first.
He's a dangerous man, vindictive and cruel. If he caught you...
What can we do, Henri?
Just stand by and watch?
You remind me of your sister, he said.
Believe me, I am not a brave woman.
Henri was quiet for a long while. Then he said,
I'll work on getting you the blank papers. You'll have to learn to forge them yourself. I am too busy to add to my duties. Practice by studying your own.
Thank you.
She paused, looking at him, remembering the note he had delivered to her all those months ago, and the assumptions Vianne had made about her sister at the time. She knew now that Isabel had been doing dangerous work from the beginning, important work. Isabel had shielded Vianne from this knowledge to protect her, even though it meant looking like a fool. She had traded on the fact that Vianne would easily believe the worst of her. Vianne was ashamed of herself for believing the lie so easily.
Don't tell Isabel I'm doing this. I want to protect her.
Henri nodded.
Au revoir,
Vianne said. On her way out, she heard him say,
Your sister would be proud of you.
Vianne neither slowed nor responded. Ignoring the German soldier's catcalling, she made her way out of the hotel and headed for home. Now all of France was occupied by the Germans, but it made little difference in Vianne's daily life. She still spent all day in one queue or another. Her biggest problem was Daniel. It still seemed smart to hide him from the villagers, even though her lie about an adoption seemed unquestioned when she told it, and she told it to everyone she could find, but people were too busy surviving to care, or maybe they guessed the truth and applauded it, who knew? She left the children at home now, hidden away behind locked doors. It meant that she was always jittery in town, nervous. Today, when she had gotten all that there was to be had for her rations, she rewrapped the woolen scarf around her throat and left the butcher's shop. As she braved the cold on Rue Victor Hugo, she was so miserable and distracted by worry, it took her a moment to realize that Henri was walking beside her. He glanced around the street, up and down. But in the wind and cold, no one was about. Shutters clattered and awnings shook. The bistro tables were empty. He handed her a baguette.
The filling is unusual. My maman's recipe.
She understood. There were papers inside. She nodded.
Bread with special filling is difficult to obtain these days. Eat it wisely.
And what if I need more bread?
More?
So many hungry children.
He stopped, turned to her, gave her a perfunctory kiss on each cheek.
Come see me again, madame.
She whispered in his ear.
Tell my sister I asked about her. We parted badly.
He smiled.
I am constantly arguing with my brother, even in war. In the end, we're brothers.
Vianne nodded, hoping it was true. She placed the baguette in her basket, covering it with the scrap of linen, tucking it alongside the blancmange powder and oatmeal that had been available today. As she watched him walk away, the basket seemed to grow heavier. Tightening her grip, she headed down the street. She was almost out of the town square when she heard it.
Madame Mauriac, what a surprise.
His voice was like oil pooling at her feet, slippery and clinging. She wet her lips and held her shoulders back, trying to look both confident and unconcerned. He had returned last evening, triumphant, crowing about how easy it had been to take over all of France. She had fed dinner to him and his men, pouring them endless glasses of wine. At the end of the meal, he had tossed the leftovers to the chickens. Vianne and the children had gone to bed hungry. He was in his uniform, heavily decorated with swastikas and iron crosses, smoking a cigarette, blowing the smoke slightly to the left of her face.
You are done with your shopping for the day?
Such as it is, Herr Sturmbannführer. There was very little to be had today, even with our ration cards.
Perhaps if your men hadn't been such cowards, your women wouldn't be so hungry.
She gritted her teeth in what she hoped passed for a smile. He studied her face, which she knew was chalky pale.
Are you all right, madam?
Fine, Herr Sturmbannführer.
Allow me to carry your basket. I will escort you home.
She gripped the basket.
No, really, it's not necessary.
He reached a black-gloved hand toward her. She had no choice but to place the twisted willow handle in his hand. He took the basket from her and began walking. She fell into step beside him, feeling conspicuous walking with an SS officer through the streets of Karivo. As they walked, von Richter made conversation. He talked about the Allies' certain defeat in North Africa. He talked about the cowardice of the French and the greediness of the Jews. He talked about the final solution, as if it were a recipe to be exchanged among friends. She could hardly make out his words over the roar in her head. When she dared to glance at the basket, she saw the baguette peeking out from beneath the red and white linen that covered it.
You are breathing like a racehorse, madam. Are you unwell?
Yes, that was it. She forced a cough, clamped a hand over her mouth.
I am sorry, Herr Sturmbannführer. I was hoping not to bother you with it, but sadly, I fear I caught the flu from that boy the other day.
He stopped.
Have I not asked you to keep your germs away from me?
He shoved the basket at her so hard it hit her in the chest. She grabbed hold of it desperately, afraid it would fall and the baguette would break open and spill false papers at his feet.
I am so sorry. It was thoughtless of me.
I will not be home for supper, he said, turning on his heel.
Vianne stood there a few moments, just long enough to be polite, in case he turned around, and then she hurried for home. Well past midnight that night, when von Richter had been abed for hours, Vianne crept from her bedroom and went to the empty kitchen. She carried a chair back to her bedroom, quietly shutting the door behind her. She brought the chair to the nightstand, tucked it in close, and sat down. By the light of a single candle, she withdrew the blank identity papers from her girdle. She took out her own identity papers and studied them in minute detail. Then she took out the family Bible and opened it. On every blank space she could find, she practiced forging signatures. At first she was so nervous that her penmanship was unsteady, but the more she practiced, the calmer she felt. When her hands and breathing had steadied, she forged a new birth certificate for Jean-Georges, naming him Émile Duval. But new papers weren't enough. What would happen when the war was over and Hélène Rouelle returned? If Vianne weren't here, with the risk she was taking, she had to consider this terrible possibility. Hélène would have no idea where to look for her son or what name he'd been given. She would need to create a fiche, a file card that had all the information she had on him, who he really was, who his parents were, any known relatives, everything she could think of. She ripped out 3 pages from the Bible and made a list on each page. On the first, in dark ink over the prayers, she wrote, Henri de Champlain, 1. Jean-Georges Rouel, 2. On the second sheet, she wrote, 1. Daniel Mauriac, 2. Émile Duval. And on the third, she wrote, 1. Garriveau, Mauriac, 2. Abbé de la Trinité. She carefully rolled each page into a small cylinder. Tomorrow, she would hide them in 3 different places. 1 in a dirty jar in the shed, which she would fill with nails. 1 in an old paint can in the barn, and 1 she would bury in a box in the chicken coop. The fiche cards she would leave with Mother at the Abbey. The cards and lists, when put together, would identify the children after the war and make it possible to get them back to their families. It was dangerous, of course, writing down any of this. But if she didn't keep a record, and the worst happened to her, how would the hidden children ever be reunited with their parents? For a long time, Vianne stared down at her work. So long that the children sleeping in her bed began to move around and mumble, and the candle flame began to sputter. She leaned over and laid a hand on Daniel's warm back to comfort him. Then she climbed into bed with her children. It was a long time before she fell asleep.